20 years old, Dorcas from Kenya was diagnosed with kidney failure. Her widowed mother had to sell everything to pay for dialysis. And then, once she received the transplant, she initially had to cover the cost of medication to help avoid graft rejection. Dorcas is just one person facing the burden of a devastating non-communicable disease and impacts of out-of-pocket expenditure to pay for treatment and care. In this episode, we dive into the multiple impacts of non-communicable diseases and how moving towards universal health coverage can mean that people like Dorcas access affordable, quality care when and where they need it. Welcome, I'm Claudia Celine-Batts, Policy and Advocacy Advisor at the George Institute, working in partnership with Imperial College London. I work on a program of policy, stakeholder engagement and thought leadership, including with the World Health Organization, United Nations and other global health organizations and networks. As well as being a member of the Action for Global Health Network, the George Institute is an internationally renowned medical research organization with a mission to improve the health of billions of people worldwide. Through research, we identify new evidence to prevent and treat non-communicable disease and injury, particularly amongst those living in disadvantaged circumstances. Our findings are subsequently used to drive change, steering towards our ultimate vision, a world where everyone lives longer, healthier lives. We extend the impact of our research by collaborating with academic institutions, civil society, patients, communities, and governments in more than 50 countries across the globe. So, universal health coverage. Before we dive into this episode where we unpack the concept, I thought it would be useful to first share the official line on universal health coverage, which is also known as UHC. Universal health coverage is the idea that everyone can access high-quality healthcare whenever they need it, without facing financial difficulties. It has three main dimensions. Firstly, it means that all individuals have the right to essential health services. Secondly, it protects people from falling into debt due to medical expenses. And thirdly, it emphasizes the importance of providing adequate and effective healthcare services. According to the World Health Organization, about half of the global population do not receive the care they require. This lack of access leads to a shocking estimate of 100 million people pushed into extreme poverty each year because they must pay for medical treatments out of their own pocket. Universal health coverage is essential because it has a positive impact on our lives in various ways. When people have access to healthcare, they can take care of their families and contribute to their community's well-being. Equally, it ensures that during public health crises, such as pandemics, we are all protected. So, on to the main show. Today, we're joined by Professors Jane Hirst and Stephen Jan. Professor Hirst is Chair in Global Women's Health at the George Institute and Consultant Obstetrician based in the NHS in Oxford. She will share her experiences as an active clinical researcher with projects focused on global women's health, sex differences in disease onset, treatment and care, and investigating novel approaches to healthcare delivery. Professor Jan is co-director of the Health System Science Program and head of the Health Economic and Process Evaluation Program at the George Institute in Sydney. He has worked closely with governments in Australia and overseas, with international agencies and industry, and will discuss the importance of UHC and share his concerns about the economic burden of non-communicable diseases on households, as well as the catastrophic impact it often carries on the most underserved populations. So, what does universal health coverage mean to you?
One is it is a global commitment. So countries through the Sustainable Development Goal have sort of committed to achieving universal health coverage by 2030, whether or not that'll happen. And there's some evidence that countries have fallen behind, particularly because of the COVID crisis. It's going to be very difficult for many countries to achieve universal health coverage, but it is something that we have a commitment to. But basically, it means basic access to healthcare for all. And there are a couple of elements to that. One is that healthcare has to be of reasonable quality. So that's an area that people need to recognise, that it can't just be any healthcare. That healthcare has to be able to be of quality such that the people sort of feel able to access it and receive the care that they need. The second aspect is it doesn't necessarily mean zero out-of-pocket costs. Sometimes healthcare systems do need to charge for healthcare. It's a case that if there is out-of-pocket cost, that it's not going to impose a significant barrier to services for people who need it, and it's not going to be at a level that's going to impose economic hardship for those who ultimately seek care. I mean, I suppose a couple of other elements. The other aspect of universal health coverage is it doesn't necessarily just mean government-only health systems. You can achieve universal health coverage through a mix of public and private systems, and different countries will try to achieve universal health coverage in different ways. So there's different pathways to it. And finally, it's not just about health services. And one element of universal health coverage that we've got good data on recent years is perhaps the biggest source of burden, particularly for people with chronic conditions, is the cost of medicine. So the ongoing costs of drugs can be a major impediment to universal health coverage.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, I agree with all those points completely. And coming at this problem as a obstetrician and gynecologist, I guess I particularly see universal health coverage from the view of women, and particularly women seeking reproductive health care and childbirth care. And in addition to everything that you've said, I wanted to bring in sort of a way I think about universal health coverage and how, you know, what health systems need to be able to provide to all the people in their communities. And a very famous public health researcher called Professor Paul Farmer, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago now, but he had, quite a nice and simple conceptual way to think about what do we need in health systems to move forward. And basically it centers around, you know, we need staff to be able to provide the cover. We can talk about this later in terms of our, you know, current NHS crisis. We need staff to be able to deliver the healthcare. So that includes the things that, you know, when you go to see the doctor that they've got in their clinic, or if you go to a hospital, they've got the scanners and the surgery equipment and all those drugs and everything there. But, you know, probably importantly, we also need the systems that are organizing all this together. So I think, Steve, you sort of alluded to it. It's not just maybe that, you know, encounter that you have, you know, that you've got a GP that you can go and see to get some care. We have to think about the whole system of referral, the whole system of community-based care, the whole system of social care, which is also important to frame around. And then finally, the other thing which I think we'll get onto in terms of who's excluded from universal health cover is often thinking about safe spaces for people. So why don't people come to health systems if it is available for them? And it might be that it's not safe because it's going to bankrupt them if they go. So there could be an economic thing, but often it can be a cultural thing, or just that they feel discriminated against, or that they're not going to get a fair go or be listened to if they go into those spaces. So I guess, yeah, we come at it probably, Steve, from two different directions. You know, you're probably thinking more big picture, I guess, as a clinician on the ground. I sort of think, yeah, how do I build up a universal health system in whatever setting I'm working in that really does reach all the people that it needs to? So, yeah, I'll leave it there. I think there's a few things I'm sure we'll explore.
Yeah, look, can I just weigh in on that point? I think a lot of the debate around universal health coverage is very economics focused. It's very much focused on the out-of-pocket costs and the role of health insurance or social insurance in protecting people from that. And admittedly, that's a very big part of universal health coverage, but we also need to recognise that access to healthcare isn't just about financial costs. It's about geography. It's about having a reliable supply chain for medicines. It's about reducing the stigma to care, and having an appropriate workforce to provide those services. It's a whole of system notion that of universal health coverage that's important. And whilst providing social insurance and financial protection is important, it's not the only thing.
Thank you so much, Bev. Reflecting on progress, I think it's really clear that universal health coverage should be a priority for governments, but also that we really need to center and listen to the voices in our communities to achieve UHC. Listeners might be wondering why we've chosen to explore the topic in this episode. This September, the United Nations in New York will host the second high-level meeting on universal health coverage, building on the first such meeting in 2019, where global leaders came together and agreed on a political declaration for universal health coverage. This declaration was a big step forward in global health because it provided a framework for governments across the world to create and put into action their own plans to achieve universal health coverage. It also emphasized the importance of a whole-of-society approach to achieve UHC by 2030, only 7 years away. In New York this September, world leaders will hopefully agree ambitious commitments to accelerate efforts towards UHC. You're listening to the Global Health Charity Show on UK Health Radio. We're going to be talking more with Steve and Jane about UHC right after this break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to the Global Health Charity Show with the George Institute for Global Health, and we're talking about UHC with Steve and Jan and Jane Hurst. Now, Steve, knowing what will be on the table in New York this September, could you please share with some examples of countries that have made progress towards universal health coverage and key learnings from their efforts for the UK?
Yeah, look, many countries, low- and middle-income countries in recent years have made good progress towards achieving universal health coverage. Countries such as China, Philippines, Thailand, India, Indonesia, they've all established mechanisms for providing stronger financial protection and comprehensive health services for their populations. And often these initiatives have taken against the background of limited resources. So many of these countries have done really well. I guess the exemplar for universal health coverage is Thailand. Over the past two decades, Thailand has achieved remarkable sort of progress in terms of providing universal health care for its population. The program that sort of was the bedrock of its universal health coverage program was called the 30 baht scheme, which is essentially a social insurance program that enabled people to access care for very minimal out-of-pocket cost. And I suppose the biggest lesson I take away from the Thai experience is that they've been able to achieve it at low cost. And part of the reason for doing that is that they've established mechanisms for ensuring that government investment in new health services isn't wasted on low-value care. So they have a mechanism for using, it's called health technology assessment, and what they do is they comprehensively assess new drugs, new procedures, new treatments that come into the health system, and they assess them on the basis of value for money and cost effectiveness. And that's important in a low-income country setting to enable the money that you have available for your health services to go as far as possible and enable maximum value from given money. I guess that's probably the biggest lesson I take away from the experience of countries like Thailand, but the UK is that, the UK, the NHS, since the 1940s has been seen as the child for universal health coverage and nationalised healthcare system. But there are, you know, chinks in the armour. In recent years, there are sort of gaps acknowledged in areas such as dental care, waiting lists for hospital procedures, waiting lists for primary care. You know, universal health coverage isn't a one-off thing. You achieve it and then you can say forever that you've achieved it. It's an ongoing battle. And I think the NHS has real challenges in being able to claim that they've achieved universal health coverage. And I think one of the things that maybe moving forward that they can take from lessons in low and middle income countries is the ability to determine where the best buys are and focus investment on in areas where they can get maximum value for money.
I can also add to that, when you mentioned NICE in the UK, I should probably declare that I'm a member of one of the NICE committees on diabetes and in pregnancy and also maternal nutrition. And I guess there's an ethos there also of the greatest good for the greatest number. So we do have a limited, you know, spending purse that can be spent on health. And I guess always in health, there's the balance between if we spend on this area, what can we not spend on somewhere else? And so there's a huge team at NICE who evaluate, you know, what's the scientific evidence behind all new treatment or innovation, you know, should we recommend it or not? Clearly, we all want to be doing things that actually have some evidence that they are going to work, you know, at least for a proportion of people. But yeah, balancing that with the financial picture, you know, and reality of the NHS and delivering care to an entire population, as you say. So, you know, I'm glad you brought that up.
I think one of the other sort of dimensions of universal health coverage is not often recognised is that there's equity in the way care is distributed. I know for many years there was talk in the UK around sort of the postcode lottery and the fact that if you're living in one postcode, you were getting different standard of care to another postcode. I think the debate around universal health coverage often just focuses on achieving basic standard of care. But I do think in countries like the UK, where we do have a bit more sort of, we can move beyond just basic care. We do need to address that issue of equity and ensuring that there aren't sort of major disparities across populations and geographical regions.
You recently co-authored a policy research report looking at the extent of out-of-pocket spending by households to receive treatment and care for non-communicable diseases, with case studies from individuals such as Zorkas. What did you find?
Yeah, look, this is a piece of work that was commissioned by the Non-Communicable Diseases Alliance, which is an NGO that represents people living with non-communicable diseases around the world, and part of their advocacy effort. And this work is intended to sort of inform some of the debates ahead of the UN high-level meeting coming up this year, and sort of helping people to sort of mobilise the arguments for stronger universal health coverage. So there were two aspects to the work that we did. One was analysis of some of diaries of people living with NCDs in a number of low and middle income countries. The second aspect was a review of the literature looking at the household burden. There's been a number of reviews done in the past few years, but we wanted to sort of do an updated review. One of the figures that you cited earlier are around, you know, the 100 million people who fall into poverty as a result of costs of disease. Worldwide, I mean, that's an estimate that's been around for a long time, and we weren't in a position to actually update that estimate. But it is, but there is evidence around that perhaps that is a bit of an underestimate, particularly given what's happened in the last couple of years with COVID. But having said that, the study itself, you know, in terms of methodology, there wasn't anything particularly novel about the methodology. I guess the aspect that was a bit unique was the access that we had to these diaries of people living with NCDs across a number of countries. In terms of what we found, from the evidence review, it's probably not too surprising that we found that there is a significant burden of associated with non-communicable diseases, and that hits people in particular on low incomes. There are big variations across income groups. The burden often tends to be greatest in people with low income, living in rural areas, and people living with long-term diseases. And often these costs are incurred through ongoing medication costs associated with treating non-communicable diseases. The other sort of lesson that we learned from the review was that the impact is often at a household level. It's important to think about the burden of costs associated with diseases, not just as something that a patient experiences, but you need to think about it as a household burden. Because one of the things we found is that the costs tend to be highest when it's a male member of the household who experiences the illness. And if you think about it, it's probably because in many of these communities, the income earner is most likely to be male and the carer is most likely to be female. So when a male patient experiences these high costs, it's almost like a double whammy. It's the loss of income, but also the burden of caring associated with the caregiver. So it is important to recognize that while some of the evidence shows that the disease costs tend to be highest in households where there's a male, it's not a male issue. In many respects, it's a burden that females experience perhaps even more significantly than males because of the fact that when they get ill, there's often a lack of carer or lack of capacity within the household to provide that care. So one of the other things that we looked at in this study, particularly in the diaries, is some of the coping strategies that households engage in. So what are the things that people do in order to make up for some of these costs? And it is often found to be, you know, resort to charities or borrowing money or taking children out of school and therefore sort of imposing on these households potential intergenerational effect. So there are sort of very sort of long-lasting and, you know, wide-ranging burdens associated with these costs that aren't just confined to the individual who's experiencing the illness.
Thank you for sharing. I think having access to the diaries and lived experiences of people with non-communicable diseases is so valuable and gets insights into how their lives and those of their households are impacted by the access to healthcare, including treatment costs. And imagine how this might look different if universal health coverage were in place. Being a member of the research team for this project, I also was particularly fascinated of our estimate that globally spending for non-communicable diseases is approximately twice as high per visit to a health facility than for infectious diseases, and how actually costs are really unequally distributed between countries. You've both spoken about sharing learning between countries and contexts. I was wondering if you might expand on what governments could do to ensure sustained and meaningful progress towards universal health coverage while leaving no one behind.
So I think there are a number of aspects to the question. I think the first aspect is that government has to be center of any initiative towards universal health coverage. Even though I mentioned earlier on that you have different pathways to universal health coverage and have it in its public-private system, I think government still has to take a central role, particularly on the financing side. So ensuring that we have adequate financial protection for every individual will require schemes or national insurance schemes or tax-based schemes which involve compulsory prepayment. So individuals have to provide sort of contributions to the healthcare through prepayment schemes, whether that be through a taxation service or whether it be through insurance. In order to provide appropriate sort of financial protection, we need schemes which, like the NHS, like in Australia, a scheme called Medicare, which asks people to contribute when they're not necessarily sick, to a pool of money that then can be collectively used to cover healthcare for the population as a whole. I don't think you can rely on a private system to provide universal health coverage, so you need leadership at the government level. The other point that you raised around the politics of this, and I think it is a really important point because different governments of different stripes will have different levels of commitment to universal health coverage. And that often comes about because people's commitment to this notion of equity and fairness differs by your political persuasion. But I think that, I guess, a universal argument for universal health coverage is that it makes sense economically as well. And as we've alluded to, it is the bedrock for providing the economic structure for economies to function properly. So having the certainty around hospital care or primary care or being able to see a doctor when you're sick is good for business, for an economy, and it provides people with the ability to sort of function within a workplace. It reduces poverty. It has these flow-on economic benefits. And I think that's an argument that perhaps enables advocates of universal health coverage to maybe sort of cut through some of the politics around it.
I agree, Stephen. The other thing when we're thinking globally is looking at the proportion the governments spend on healthcare, because that varies a lot around the world as well. And, you know, we're all, you know, constantly hearing about how expensive healthcare is to the government in the UK, but also many other high-income countries are facing a very substantial part of their tax revenue goes on healthcare spending. But what we find when we look at many low- and middle-income countries is that it's a much, much smaller piece of the pie that those countries have allocated to healthcare. So their ability to be able to deliver healthcare to their population along the ethos of universal healthcare is often very severely curtailed, allowing for the fact that, you know, GDP per capita is going to be a lot less, you know, that the impacts of out-of-pocket expenses can be a lot more catastrophic to people at the lower end of the spectrum than people, you know, earning decent or higher end wages. So I think, yeah, when we think about what the UN resolutions can do and where we should go, I think moving towards a kind of, you know, recognition that there needs to be a certain level of commitment across all countries, and perhaps, you know, like other resolutions, you know, that may be tied to donor aid, or it may be tied to other incentive packages to be part of the global economy, you know, to so countries can move forward. That may be something that is considered. But of course, these things have to be endorsed by the member states, and there'll be pushback from many different lobby groups and many different people. I mean, there's, you know, my own profession, a medical profession, that often, you know, has benefited enormously from privatized medical systems where doctors can pay for or charge patients, you know, essentially what they want, or a market rate for healthcare provision. And yeah, in many countries, yeah, including the private sector within the NHS, you know, people can make a lot of money. And so there's an incentive by people who probably are very well educated, have quite a strong voice in the ear of parliamentarians and things, to maybe not, you know, commit to a public delivered model of care completely. And I think, you know, you see this play out in the US and other countries, you know, to different extents. But it is a complicated issue. But I think, you know, we do need, if we are to achieve that 2030 goal or even come anywhere close to it, you know, there needs to be a recognition that more money needs to be put into universal healthcare.
Thank you both. So you've both touched on this already in your reflections around equity and the different types of burden that non-communicable diseases impose on households, as well as the different members in it, particularly gendered roles around caregiving and access. In that vein, Jane, from your work, what are the biggest barriers and opportunities to improving access to quality care for people in need or seeking support? And what role do sex differences play?
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a big question, I think. So you know, obviously I can only maybe address partially or in a very small way, but I think there are a couple of sides to this. There's the supply and the demand side, you know, when we look at healthcare. So when we look at the demand for healthcare, I guess, yeah, the health system essentially relies on mostly on people coming to it, you know, with symptoms, and the symptoms will then be managed in whatever way. And I think part of our problem in women's health is that many symptoms women experience can often be trivialized or dismissed, or women are not aware that they're at risk of certain conditions. And the prime example there is, of course, heart disease and you know, heart attacks, which, you know, when we look at most countries around the world now, non-communicable diseases, and particularly heart disease and stroke, the leading causes of death in women. Whilst if we go to the street and we ask, you know, 100 women, what do you think most women die of? Most people will come up with things like breast cancer or female-specific conditions that we hear about, not unimportantly, but, you know, relatively they're not contributing all the burden of disease. So whilst there's been a lot of public health campaigns about this self-checks for breast cancer, to, you know, if you have a breast lump, please go and see your doctor straight away, and people should definitely do that, as well as cervical screening programs that we know about, the smear tests, which all women, you know, up to the age of 70 are advised to go and have regularly with their primary care practice. A lot of effort's gone in there, but then I think, you know, there are some blind spots in how gendered, you know, medical conditions. We think of the typical person who gets a heart attack as a overweight middle-aged man who probably smokes and, you know, might be really stressed out at work or something like that. That's the sort of a cliche, but that's not actually the reality. So as I say, part of it is that. And then the other part, you know, as I mentioned, is sort of on the supply side as to what health systems, how they're actually structured. And in the UK, there was a large survey done about 18 months ago now, looking at women's healthcare access and provision in the UK and what women want. And they actually had over 110,000 responses to this. And what came out was that women felt that many health spaces were not woman friendly, were not, really addressing their needs at the time and the way that they wanted to access care. Care services were very fragmented. So, for example, you know, I might go to my GP to get a script for the contraceptive pill, but then I might have to go, you know, somewhere else to get, you know, if I wanted to have screening for osteoporosis or something like that, I might have to go to a different clinic. Or, you know, things are just not joined up in women's healthcare. And so the UK government, you know, listening to this, have now appointed Dame Professor Leslie Reagan as the first women's health ambassador in the UK. And her role is to really think as how can we orientate the NHS to deliver healthcare to women in the UK in the way that women and girls, I should say, want it and can engage with that care well. So they're balancing up, as I say, both sides of the story there around the gender piece. I can talk more about the gender sort of challenges that maybe some other places have, like in India, where at the George Institute, we do a lot of work there and have a number of programs going on. You know, there the issues for women are even more stark, with the gender difference in countries like India being very, very marked. I think India, you know, score in the bottom sort of quarter when we look at gender parity indices around the world. And what this translates to is sort of a general sort of devaluing of women and women's health across the life course. And we can see that from the time of birth, where we have really marked differences in the number of boy babies and girl babies being born in some states in India and some locations, to, you know, how they access healthcare and where the money for healthcare is going to be spent throughout their lives. So, you know, that situation is clearly extremely complex and is rooted in society, culture, systems that are in place. But I think there are a lot of challenges for women to access healthcare. And might I just say, you know, whilst I'm a professor of women's health and that's where I've been focused my entire life, we mustn't also forget men. There are a lot of men's health issues where men don't have a safe space or somewhere they feel they can access and don't seek care appropriately. You know, particularly we know they are likely to seek care a lot later for many conditions, including mental health. And the other group, which I think are almost sort of forgotten in this debate a lot of the time, are people who are non-binary gender, people who are intersex, people who are trans, and health services that are sensitive and welcoming to those people, unfortunately still are fairly few and far between. And particularly when we look at trans men who may have been born as biological females but are no longer women, they're men, they will be experiencing still some of the same gynecologic complications that we associate it with women's health. But most of the systems that are offered treatments and services are all branded under the women's health banner, and it may not be seen as a welcoming space for people who don't identify as women. So this is something that we're, you know, really trying to tackle. How do we just be more kind to people in across all genders in society? How do we make our services more inclusive and welcoming, and gender is not a reason why people feel they can't access or don't access care.
I think that gender dimension to universal health coverage is really important. That's not often picked up in the policy debate. One bit of research that we did recently to explore this was a review of some of the literature around childhood cancers, and we wanted to explore whether there were any differences in abandonment of treatment between boys and girls across different studies. And while we didn't find very strong evidence across all the studies done worldwide, what we did find was an interesting trend in the studies that were than in India, where there are very strong sort of gender norms that sort of bias, could be seen to be biased against women. The four studies that were done there was very strong signal of higher rates of treatment abandonment amongst girls with the cancer. And this sort of highlights the point that, you know, when, as there are in India, there are high out-of-pocket costs associated with treatment. India has perhaps one of the highest levels of out-of-pocket costs associated with healthcare treatment. It's a very privatized system. It is making progress, but that's only been in the past few years. Historically, it's been very much a private system. And so families, when they get ill, they face very high out-of-pocket costs. Combine that with very strong sort of gender norms that are biased against girls and women will mean that, you know, when families are faced with major illness, there are differences likely in the way in which they make decisions about whether people proceed with care. So with universal health coverage, with stronger financial protection around these costs, we're hopefully likely to see that manifestation of gender bias sort of lessen in countries like India. I think that's an important aspect of universal health coverage.
You've both brought to the fore some of the challenges and differences in accessing healthcare. What also jumped out to me personally was how important joined-up care and access is to ensuring coverage is universal, enabling all people to live longer in better health. With that in mind, how can digital technology support UHC?
Very happy to talk about that, because I think, you know, it's easy for Steve and I and others, you know, to sort of moan about, you know, the current state of play and the challenges that we face. And the challenges are vast, you know, no one's denying that. But I think we also need to be thinking, all right, so how can we creatively leverage what we have in our power in 2023 and looking ahead, and where's the way forward here? And I think all of us have been, yeah, our lives have been completely transformed by the digital revolution. And I think with the coming of sort of AI and machine learning technologies as they are now starting to come of age, I think, you know, we've only just sort of scratched the surface. And so what we're looking at in India is how we can use digital technologies to try and improve the way that we pick up women who have either high-risk conditions during pregnancy and also women who have risk factors for maybe developing a non-communicable disease, you know, after pregnancy or later in their life. So the idea being that in many settings around the world, and to some extent, including the UK, you know, when women or anyone is sort of young and supposedly healthy, they probably don't have that many encounters with the formal health system. So when young women become pregnant, that's one time when there are some really good systems now in most places around the world to provide antenatal care and delivery care and postnatal care. And particularly antenatal care had a lot of investment into it. But one of the problems with antenatal care is it often requires women to get themselves to a clinic or a hospital to have the check with their midwife or their doctor. And for many women who are living in rural and poor settings or remote settings around the world, that might prove quite difficult to do more than once or twice, you know, during their pregnancy. So what we're doing is working with our partners at the George Institute in India to use a digital tool we call Smart Health, which enables the community health workers who are living in the villages where these women work to do some of that first level screening in the women's homes. So for those who are not familiar with the concept of community health workers, these are normally mostly women in most places around the world, but some places they're men. But they generally have an education to about grade 10 at school, so they're literate, but they haven't gone to any formal healthcare college or training or university or anything like that. So they're not part of the formal health system. Their role in many places around the world is to, you know, support pregnant mothers and newborn babies and make sure that children get their vaccinations on time and act as sort of, you know, healthcare activists. And in fact, in India, they're called ASHA workers, which is accredited health and social care activists. So what we're doing in Smart Health Pregnancy is we've trained the ASHA workers to do some basic screening on women. So we give them automated blood pressure machines to screen for preeclampsia. We give them handheld devices so they can check for anemia and for diabetes in pregnancy, these three conditions being the most common medical complications that are, you know, experienced in those areas. And the idea being that it's more convenient for the women to be screened in their home or their even in their place of work. And if a pregnant woman does show signs that she is developing any of these high-risk conditions, there's a system that's built in to refer her to the primary healthcare doctor who can then hopefully offer her care. So, you know, the system, as I say, the digital technology within that system acts to support the way that the healthcare workers make decisions around what is normal and what is not. As I say, they're not educated as health workers. So, you know, why would they know what a normal blood pressure looks like or what the care pathway should be? And, you know, this at the moment, we're testing this in two states in India, in Haryana, which is a state in the north, and in Telangana, a state in the south, across 60 villages between those two states. And we've trained a couple of hundred community health workers to use the system. And you know, we've, you know, got nearly 3,000 women enrolled in the project so far. So, you know, the feedback we're getting from the ground is extremely positive. You know, that people are really valuing this and finding it to be useful. But like with all medical research, you know, the proof is in the pudding when we actually evaluate at the end of the trial whether we've made an impact on people's health and their lives. So watch this space for that project. The other, a couple of other exciting developments that are going on with Smart Health at the moment is we've recently got some funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to incorporate large language models into our smart health platform. So that's things like ChatGPT, because at the moment the system, you know, you enter in the numbers and the system will tell you what should be done. But there's no way for community health workers or even when they're with the pregnant women and their families to actually get any more information or ask questions that are particular to them. So we're trying to set up a system which would be more conversational, where, you know, the issues that are actually important to women, it might be outside those conditions I've mentioned, you know, there'd be a way to ask and get guideline-based advice and support, you know, not just support off the Google search, but really based on what the local Indian guidelines say and how pregnancy should be managed. So again, watch this space. You know, I think it's a really, it's our first step into incorporating large language models into the Smart Health platform. And I think the potential for this for healthcare workers in many, many other settings is really, really great. So we're doing lots of exciting things. And the question that always gets asked of me when I talk about Smart Health is, why aren't we doing this in the NHS? Good question. I mean, this is something that could be done in the NHS. It could be done, you know, with, you know, people at maybe health visitor level training or even community volunteers who are working. And there are some pilot community health worker projects in the UK now. You know, some of the boroughs of London and things are trying to use this model to reach populations who are experiencing disadvantage for whatever reason, be it economic, be it racial, be it, you know, gender, all the things that, you know, we can all associate with why people might struggle to access mainstream care. So I think, yeah, whilst we're developing this in the rural Indian context, at the moment it's tailored for there, I think it has a potentially a much wider impact on other settings.
Just picking up on that, I was meaning to ask, what solutions do you think are the most important in redressing inequalities in care access within the NHS specifically? And how can we build health systems that are resilient, sustainable and accessible globally?
Yeah, look, I would argue, they're not necessarily everything, as you say, but they are important aspects of achieving resilient, long-term, sustainable health systems that provide universal health coverage for their populations. It's often said that, you know, there's a trade-off between equity and efficiency, that if you try to have an efficient system, that's not necessarily going to be equitable. I would argue that in the context of universal health coverage, that argument isn't true, that achieving efficient healthcare systems through things like low-cost, sustainable programs, like Jane was talking about, the community health worker programs, Smart Health, they're all efficiency, potentially a very efficient programs. They enable healthcare systems to then expand coverage to populations that weren't previously served. It gives the health system itself the potential savings through low-cost care to provide coverage across the population level. So in many ways, they're complementary goals, and I think that's probably sort of the high-level argument I would make, that you know, trying to achieve efficiency, ensuring low-cost, affordable, cost-effective care is an important part of this whole sort of push towards universal health coverage and achieving equity.
I agree, and I think when we're thinking about how health systems should be structured in the future to deliver universal healthcare, it's always important to, you know, put the individual and the family at the center of that journey. So, like Steve described, the listening to the patient journey stories, because it's often, you know, lost that the reason why people can't access care is because they're expected to travel, you know, a very large distance to get to the clinic that offers that specialist service, and they don't have any transport, or they're an elderly person who's very frail, and that's not a potential, you know, solution for them. So that's why, as I said, you know, I'm really, yeah, encouraged in the NHS that they have committed to this idea of women's health hubs and trying to think about, you know, what people want, you know, getting it sort of a one-stop shop, I guess, is what we would all like to do, you know, when we access healthcare. But clearly, you know, we need to think, you know, creatively about how we can use new technologies, new ways to deliver the efficiency in the healthcare so it can be done within a limited budget envelope. That's always going to be the case.
Thank you so much, Jane. You're listening to the Global Health Charity Show on UK Health Radio. Join us after the break to learn more about opportunities to get involved in the UHC movement ahead of the UN high-level meeting this September.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, in the course of our conversation, we've started with the experience of Dorcas in Kenya, unpacked whether the UK's National Health Service really is the poster child for universal health coverage. I've also heard about successes of the Thai health system, the power of innovative and digital care delivery in India. So now, imagine that we are in New York at the high-level meeting on universal health coverage. What would your call to action be to political leaders also in attendance?
Yeah, look, I think I would go back to Jane's point. I think governments need to invest in primary care. In terms of return on investment, I think if you take a broad whole society approach, investing in universal health coverage, particularly through primary care, will enable people to have access to care when they're needed, but also provide foundations for strong economic activity by providing people with the certainty that they'll receive healthcare when they need it, ensuring families don't fall into poverty when they're accessing healthcare. There are really strong arguments, not just from the health sector perspective, but from a broader social and economic perspective for investing in universal health coverage.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I'd add to that, you know, that when governments do invest in universal health coverage, that, you know, they take a gender sensitive approach to everything that they do, and that they really have a focus on equity as they move forward. Because a big problem in all countries is that, you know, there are pockets of the population that just seem to miss out again and again and again on getting access to services, access to care. So making sure that, you know, what is provided, not just that it's available, but that it's accessed equitably, you know, how can we move forward on that agenda? I think that's extremely important. And then the final point that I would bring in is thinking about universal health coverage, not in a silo, like we're just not health people. We need to think about what else is happening. So obviously climate change is a big thing. How is that going to affect how we can provide universal health coverage? What do we need to think of in terms of emergency and disaster relief as we're going to get more extreme weather events and things? How do we think about the next pandemic and how that's going to, you know, potentially cause disruption like we saw with COVID? You know, we're basically no area was untouched around the world from COVID, was it? So I think it is a debate that needs to happen, you know, across governments, across sections of government, and yeah, more than just throwing money at the problem. We need to build a system that is equitable and sustainable within our changing world.
Powerful rallying calls that underscore why accelerating action towards and ultimately achieving universal health coverage matters to us all. So, listeners might be wondering how they can take action. So it's really timely that I flag the NCD Alliance hosted Global Week for Action on Non-Communicable Diseases in September. The campaign is held every year, and the theme this year is Bridging the Care Gap. 50% of the world's population do not have access to essential health services, and we all have a role in changing that. You can get involved in the campaign on social media by hosting an event or igniting conversations on the topic in your own community. And if you have lived experience of a non-communicable disease, have been impacted by affordability of care or a lack of access to services, you might wish to consider sharing your experiences as a voice for care. Your story is so important if we are to adopt people-centered approaches in the pursuit to UHC. At the George Institute, we are researching the best ways to implement effective, equitable healthcare systems that consider the whole person. We call on governments to ensure that everyone has access to high-quality, people-centered and integrated healthcare throughout their lives without incurring financial hardship. Join us in this call.